They did, and they'll decline even more when this bubble finally bursts. All of this shows us that the next depression is due to be at its worst between the late 2060s and the mid-2070s, and we'll have declining birth rates and immigration trends after 2007 to thank for that. The most dynamic parts of Asia, from India to Southeast Asia, will be on a demographic decline by then as well, and will mature in urbanization, which creates the greatest productivity growth. The world economy will literally move sideways between the 2020s and the 2070s as this great revolution plays out. Only after that will we see another great global boom, more like the one from 1983 to 2007. This period, from the 2020s through the 2070s, will likely end up being similar to 1720 to 87. When European stocks saw a 67-year sideways or bear market. Only this one will be livelier, briefly just coming into its peaks around 2036 and 2056. Where the world will be more expansive will be in India and Southeast Asia. There will be another great commodity boom, driven more by the demographics and urbanization of emerging countries that are more commodity-intensive. I will discuss these two powerful trends in chapters 17 and 18. Unfortunately, most of us today will be dead before much of this unfolds. So what do we do now? First, we understand how bad this could get. A world of hurt. The Trump rally that started in early November 2016 very likely represents the final orgasm in a rare series of bubbles, the last and most extreme, made possible only by endless government QE and stimulus. This fourth and final stock bubble in this economic winter season has grown exponentially, as all bubbles do before they burst. It's larger in both point terms and percentage gains than the unprecedented 1995 to 2000 tech and internet-driven bubble. And first crashes are typically 40% plus within 2.5 months, on the way down to 80% plus, as my bubble model shows. More on this in the next chapter. This has been the case in most of the strong stock bubbles, like 1929, 1989, Japan, 2000, and 2015, China. That's why it's better to get out a bit early than late. Let's break this down into the key markets and look at the possible future we face. The NASDAQ. Potential loss equals 88%. The NASDAQ was bubbling the most as I wrote this in May 2017. It was thanks largely to just five FAANG, or FANG, stocks. Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. They were driving the S&P 500 up as well. If I make that sound like a problem, it's because it is. These are great companies, but so were General Motors and General Electric before the Great Depression. Every time just a handful of companies have driven the market like this, the bubble has burst. Every time. The dot-com bubble took the NASDAQ from 800 to 5,050. That was a 6.3 times gain in just over 5 years. Crazy! Then we had a long correction, a classic ABC, into early 2009. The index ultimately lost 78% during this time. The next wave up to new highs looks like it'll peak around 6,500 to 6,600, and then experience its first crash starting by late October. That jolt could see the index lose close to 40%. The ultimate support for the NASDAQ is between the late 1994 low of 800 and the early 2009 low of 1100. That means it could lose 83 to 88% before all is said and done, and this crash has wrapped up. Recall that the Dow lost 90% between late 1929 and late 1932. Small caps, signaling the top. Small-cap stocks tend to do the best in a strong boom, because the smart money invests there to grab the bigger gains, and it takes more sophistication to do that. so when the smart money starts to exit, the small caps tend to lead on the way down. It's a telltale sign. The top in stocks on May 17, 2017, didn't see new highs for the Russell 2000, the index that tracks small caps. That could be the first sign of an important divergence for this bubble since March 2009. If the Russell 2000 moves sideways for a while, and then doesn't make a new high on the next sharp move, that would signal that this bubble is done. The same thing happened between August and October 2007 in the previous top. The Dow Jones. Potential loss equals 75% to 83%. On the PDF, you'll find the Dow Megaphone chart. The logic is simple and obvious, although no Wall Street experts talk about it. Each of the past three bubbles has made new highs, only for those peaks to be followed by new lower lows. The projected low for the Dow was around 5,500, or more than 75% below the projected highs of between 22,000 and 23,000 just ahead. If it returns to its bubble origin in late 1994 to around 3,800, which, as I'll show in the next chapter, is typical, the loss would be 83%. S&P 500. Potential loss equals 83%. Finally, the S&P 500 is the best summary chart for the U.S. economy. It looks like a final fifth wave will peak around 2,600 or a bit higher. The first support is the 2009 low of 642. That's 75% down, just like the Dow. The ultimate support is at the beginning of the bubble, in December 1994. That means the S&P 500 could lose as much as 83% by the time the crash is over. Chapter 10. The model that politicians and investors desperately need. Bubbles are just like orgasms. This makes them predictable, as Masters and Johnson would say. Harry Dent. Obviously, we're in a bubble. If you skipped Chapter 9, go back and listen to it now. And if you really want an education on bubbles, get my last book, The Sale of a Lifetime, or check out my website, dentresources.com. The cycles have brought us here. Central bankers' and politicians' follies have aggravated the situation and created a third, totally artificial bubble in stocks that is more extreme than ever, and a second bubble in real estate. And the experts don't seem to see or understand any of it. When this bubble bursts, I'm willing to bet you they'll cry, "Black Swan!" They're idiots. This bubble burst, and all those that have come before and will come after are totally predictable. And I've created the prototype that helps us see how these events will most likely unfold, years in advance. It's my bubble model. Before I detail this model for you, I will say that, while inflating and deflating bubbles are easy to predict, nailing down the precise day and time the chaos will begin is near impossible, due to the extreme irrationality at the top. Think of it like this. If you keep dropping one grain of sand at a time onto the floor, a mound will build. It will get steeper and steeper until it looks like a Hershey's Kiss, a clear sign of a bubble in its late stage. That's when you know that an avalanche or crash is coming. That's easy to predict. But there will be literally just one single grain of sand that will suddenly cause the mound to collapse. Predicting that one single grain of sand is just not possible. But working with Andy now and using this bubble model, we can get as close to it as possible, damn it. Our best guess as of early August, the time of this writing, mid to late October. When it comes to bubbles, especially in stocks, it's easier to see the downside risks and roughly how long it will take a bubble to unwind once it is built exponentially and is in the orgasmic final bubble stage. And this is what we want to know about, because it's how we avoid the pandemonium and financial injuries that are inevitable when the sky falls. I've said it thousands of times in my previous books, in my newsletters, in my speeches. But I'll say it again. Bubbles don't correct. They crash and burn. If you try to time the peak to the day, you'll lose, because the first rapid crash can see as high as 50% of the total crash occur in just a matter of months. Even the few people who see bubbles rarely see the extent of the downside risks. They think that such bubbles in financial asset values can plane out for a while or correct 20% to 50%, like what you see during normal longer-term bull markets. That never happens. That's what makes my bubble model so vital. It works around five key principles. Key principle one. Bubbles begin when stocks, or any financial asset, start growing faster than the more linear or fundamental trends, most often well after the bottom of the last major correction or crash. As this trend builds, investors increasingly buy, just because a market is going up faster than usual, for a long enough period of time to give them confidence in their decision. Greed and speculation start to take hold. Fundamentals fly the coop. I call this point the bubble origin, and I'll show ahead why that's important. Key principle two. Bubbles then build exponentially for several years, typically 5 to 6 years in stocks, and often longer in real estate. Key principle three. The greater the bubble, the greater the burst. Bubbles vary in intensity, which determines both their height and how big their crash. I calculate the bubble intensity by taking the times gain, how much it increased in value, expressed as a ratio, instead of a percentage, and dividing that by the length of time from origin to peak. So, for example, if a bubble took 5 years to triple from bottom to top, a 3.0 times gain, the bubble intensity is 0.6. This allows me to compare bubbles in different asset sectors with historical ones, especially if their durations differ. Key principle four. Bubbles then burst, typically twice as fast as they build, and more so with stocks than with commodities or real estate, which take about the same time to burst as they do to build. The typical stock bubble is about 5 to 6 years in length, with a 2.5 to 3-year crash after the peak. This was the case with the stock bubbles in the late Roaring Twenties in the United States, the Japan Nikkei bubble in the 1980s, and tech stocks in the latter 1990s. The typical real estate bubble is roughly 6 to 10 years, taking about as long to unwind because property is far less liquid than stocks, and people have more of an emotional stake because they live there. Key principle 5. Most important, bubbles tend to go back to where they started, at what I referred to earlier as the bubble origin. Sometimes they won't quite make it all the way down. Other times they'll drop even lower. That's why it's so important to identify where a bubble started. That is your best estimate of your downside potential, and it will scare the crap out of you, as it should. Knowing these five principles, along with several other factors, gives us a good idea of where the crash will end and how far it's likely to go down. At this point, I need to take you on a quick and important detour. How simple linear trends always go exponential. My first principle of bubbles is that all long-term growth is exponential, not linear. Then I say that when we get an exponential trend from the nearer-term fundamental linear trend, that's the bubble origin. Sounds a little contradictory, I'll admit, but it's not. The best and easiest way to think about this is with the principle of compound interest or growth. If you take a constant 3% growth rate, which is apparently linear, and compound that growth, which means that 1% becomes 1.03%, and then 1.06%, and so on, that seemingly linear trend becomes exponential over time. That 3% trend is building on an increasingly larger base, like that mound of sand being built one grain at a time. Your experience in investing is linear if you withdraw your gains every year and spend them. If you reinvest them, they ultimately become exponential. That's why systematic saving is so important to building wealth over the longer term. That's why you can become wealthy if you just invest consistently from a young age and then reinvest those gains in dividends. Knowledge and evolution are also exponential in the long term. They build on themselves and compound naturally. The more knowledge grows, the more it builds on itself. Ultimately, it comes down to perspective. If you look at the horizon when both your feet are planted firmly on the ground, the earth looks flat. Go up just 100 miles, and immediately you can see the earth's curve. Look at a trend close up, and it'll appear to be linear. Step away and take a longer-term view, and you'll see that it's actually exponential and cyclical. When bubbles pop up in the late stages of a long-term growth trend, they're simply reflecting the late and extreme stages of such compounded and exponential growth. This always comes in the economic fall season, or peak, of any four-stage cycle, like the colors of leaves morphing to their greatest beauty before they die in winter. So when the seemingly linear trend of 7% real stock growth shifts gears and races to 15 or 20% plus, you know it's nearing the end. With all that being said, let's return to the point of this chapter, my bubble model. Creating the baselines. My model starts with the male orgasm chart from Masters and Johnson. I explained extensively in The Sale of a Lifetime why I use this chart as a guide to seeing and predicting bubbles, but for those who haven't read my last book, I'll quickly explain. Quite simply, financial bubbles are exactly like orgasms. I can put the scientifically documented male orgasm chart over any major market chart and tell whether it's a bubble or just a normal healthy bull market, like 1942 to 68. Take a look at this chart on the PDF and see for yourself. After a bubble has begun to form, I draw a trend line through the linear fundamental trend going back to the last bottom, where the markets first diverge above those trends and keep diverging exponentially, is the bubble origin. The bubble accelerates into the last blow-off, and that's when we know the peak is getting close. We saw this clearly from late 1998 to early 2000 in the dramatic tech bubble, and from early 2016 into 2017 in this one. The Trump rally from November 2016 into 2017 looks very much like that final blow-off rally and top. As that top approaches, I can calculate the intensity of the bubble and compare it with other current or past bubbles. Long before the actual top, I know the downside potential because the sector should return at least near the bubble origin. Once the bubble starts to burst, and it typically does so violently, with 30 to 50% of the total decline occurring in the first sharp crash in just 2 to 3 months, I can estimate about how long the overall crash will take by calculating the time it took to rise from the bubble origin to the peak, and then taking 50% off that. That's why calculating the bubble origin is more important than just looking at the last long-term low before the bull market began. It's important to note, though, that this calculation is for stocks only. It's a bit different for commodities and real estate. And it's really that simple. The model in action. The Japanese stock market enjoyed the first major baby boom bubble from late 1984 through late 1989. Then it crashed dramatically into late 1992. Just as the rest of the world was starting to live large through the greatest boom in modern history. I alone predicted that bubble crash back in 1988 to 89, in my presentations and my first book, Our Power to Predict. In Figure 10.2 on the PDF, you'll see that Nikkei bubble chart again, but this time with my bubble model applied. I went back several years and drew that fundamental trend line. This showed me that the Nikkei started going exponential from around late 1984 when the index was at about 8,000. That was the bubble origin. It then exploded into the very end of 1989, reaching 39,000. That gives it a gain of 4.4 times. The bubble lasted 5.5 years and had an intensity rating of 0.8, a bit higher than average for stocks. My model forecast that the crash would have lasted 2.75 years, with a 77% decline. The actual first extended crash saw a loss of 64%, but was very close to the model's time estimate in late 1992. The reason the crash was a bit less intense than expected was because the rest of the world was recovering from the 1990 to 91 recession and was beginning the greatest stock boom in history, as I also predicted back in 1988 to 89. The first very sharp crash saw a 31% decline in less than 3 months, declaring that a top had finally occurred. After a brief bounce, the market went down 49% in just the first 8 months. Again, that's why you get out a bit early. The crash lasted 2.75 years, in this case exactly 50% of the 5.5-year rise, and first bottomed 64% down in July 1992. Just above the bubble origin. The ultimate low, thus far, down 80%, at just 7,600, came in early 2003, when Japan's demographic trends were at their worst. Eventually, this bubble did erase all of its gains and go back to the bubble origin. Looking at the most prominent stock bubbles in modern history, you can see we get dynamics and parameters similar to those of the Nikkei bubble. Stock crashes are both more rapid and predictable because investors can panic much faster than they can with real estate, which is far less liquid, and people most often live in it. The major bubble preceding the Nikkei collapse was the infamous Roaring Twenties stock bubble that peaked in September 1929, a moment in history we are all too familiar with as the eve of the Great Depression. Its bubble origin date was very late 1924, and it peaked in late 1929. It saw a 3.8 times gain in just 5 years, with a bubble intensity of 0.78, similar to Japan's bubble. My model projected that the crash would last 2.5 years and see losses of as much as 74%, but the actual crash was worse, as the whole world collapsed together, unlike with Japan's great crash. By July 1932, the Dow had lost 89%. The NASDAQ bubble of 2000 had its bubble origin in very late 1994. It peaked in early March of 2000, building over 5.2 years. The gain was a whopping 6.8 times, so it had a bubble intensity of 1.31, the highest major developed country stock bubble in modern history. No wonder the PE was so extreme. The bubble took exactly half the time to unwind, losing 78%. My model projected an 85% loss. Over in China, the Shanghai Composite saw the most dramatic short-term bubble from very late 2005 into October 2007. It had a 5.2 times gain in just 2 years and a bubble intensity off the charts at 3.0. That's the highest I've ever seen. The crash bottomed in early November of 2008 at 72%, only slightly above my forecast target of 81% down. That is still very close for a forecast of such a volatile event. And the timing was right on. 2 years up, 1 year down. Then came the second bubble in the NASDAQ, biotech. It took 3.75 years to create a 4.2 times gain into mid-2015. Its bubble intensity was 1.12, nearly as high as the first NASDAQ bubble. Its initial crash saw losses of 40% in the first 2.5 months, the classic sign of a bubble beginning to burst, and yet more evidence for why you should get out a bit early rather than later. The S&P 500 is the best reflection of the U.S. economy, the best house in a bad neighborhood globally. It looks to Andy and me as though it will most likely peak around mid to late October. But of course, that's just our best guess, though likely a good one. Assuming that date for a peak, with a top at around 2600, this index will see its third and final bubble origin in early March 2009, enjoying a 4x gain. Its bubble intensity will be at a more typical 0.48. The first bubble was the most dynamic. Everyone since then has been less intense, given slower demographic and technological trends, not to mention steadily worsening geopolitical trends. The current bubble is the worst because it's totally artificial, driven by 0% interest rates and endless QE. My model here projects an 83% crash in late 2022. That's perfectly in line with my generational spending wave turning up again longer term in 2023. But most of the damage should be seen by early 2020, when my four fundamental cycles still point down together. I would expect the S&P 500 and the Dow to be down around 75% by then, and down 83% by late 2022. To go back to the original bubble origin in late 1994, the S&P would have to fall to 450, and the Dow to 3,800. Do you want to sit through that scenario? Commodity bubbles, the drama queens. Commodities have more extreme bubbles and crashes. They often collapse faster during the initial burst. They're more likely to bottom at the bubble origin or lower. And there is more variation between different sectors, making an apples-to-apples comparison essential. Because of this, commodity bubbles are perhaps hardest to predict. That's why the best traders are commodity traders. Look at the broader commodity bubble in the chart on the PDF. The Thomson Reuters Core Commodity CRB Index, TRCC-CRB Index, is the most basic commodities index. Just look at the bubble from around late 2003 into early 2008. Over 6.4 years, it went up 3.1 times with an intensity of 0.48. And look at that first dramatic burst. The index lost 58%, and in just 8 months, from March 2008 to November 2008. That's just 12% of the time it took the bubble to build. The low thus far has already been minus 67%, and should be lower still into 2018 or later. I'm talking down a total of 74% or more. Commodities were among the first to crash in this global bubble environment, and they'll likely be the first to bottom as well. It's likely to be an earlier rally in the emerging countries, with their strong demographics outside of China, that lifts commodities out of their nosedive. But note that people always claim that I'm being extreme in my downside forecasts. That's not because I'm bearish by nature. It's because I understand bubbles. I was also more bullish than almost anyone for most of my career, because I understood the magnitude of the baby boom generation, and I understood that you get bubbles in the fall season's boom. Oil's bubble and crash was the most extreme of the lot, going from $32 in late 2004 to $147 in mid-2008, just 3.6 years, and then crashing back down to $32 in just 4.5 months. I had never seen a bubble crash that hard and fast until oil's spectacular display. Oil advanced 5.4 times in a short period, so its bubble intensity was 1.13, very high. Then it crashed 79% in just 4.5 months. Holy crap! You wouldn't have wanted to get out of that one a little late. Oil is likely to bottom somewhere between $8 and $20 by late 2018, or maybe as late as early 2020. That will mean an 86-95% decline from its peak of $147 in mid-2008. However, typical commodity bubbles are more like real estate bubbles and tend to take about the same amount of time to reach their ultimate bottom as it took the bubble to build. I'll talk about real estate in the next chapter. Commodity bubbles are more likely to vary from the model estimates for both time and severity of the crash. Copper is the more typical industrial metal that follows the economy, because it goes into so many different products. Its bubble origin was in mid-2003, and it peaked in early 2011, with a 4.6 times gain and an intensity of 0.59 over 7.75 years. It's already been down 56% at worst in early 2016. My model projects that copper's crash will continue into around late 2019 or early 2020, ultimately losing as much as 84% from its peak. Commodities could peak earlier, given how much most have already come down. Then we come to one of the areas of greatest interest, gold. First, gold at its core is a commodity. The greatest consumers are the two countries with the largest populations, China and India. Second, gold has been in a bubble like all other commodities. The last time gold bubbled was into early 1980, along with the broader commodity sector, and then it crashed first into 1986 and ultimately bottomed between 1998 and 2001. Third, gold correlates most with inflation, as commodities in general do. It is not a safe place to be during deflationary times, which we face ahead. Gold's latest bubble origin started around mid-2005, when the yellow metal was close to $450. Its ultimate low was $250 back in 2001. The most likely target would be $450 by early 2020, and perhaps sooner. From 2005, though, it went up 3.5 times over 6.25 years into late 2011, giving it a bubble intensity of 0.56. That's a bigger bubble than stocks saw. From the 2001 low, gold went up 7.7 times. Gold has already been down as much as 46% in early 2016, despite the greatest money printing spree in history. At the $450 target, that would represent a 77% crash from its September 2011 high of $1,934. The commodity bubble with the most extreme bubble intensity and most persistent crash is iron ore. That bubble started in late 2007 and exploded into early 2011, with a higher intensity than oil at a whopping 1.26. That was a 3.25 times gain in just 4.5 years. Of course there would be a big crash. It's already lost as much as 78% by early 2016. It could lose as much as 88% by late 2018 or early 2020 at the latest. Here's a bubble that clearly shows that crashes like 80% are to be expected when a bubble bursts. It's not outrageous. Commodities are showing us what is likely to happen to other volatile markets like stocks. And finally, corn. I keep hearing people say that the one thing people can't stop doing in a downturn is eating. So there's little downside in agricultural commodities. Well, tell that to corn prices. In 6 years, corn bubbled up 3.3 times into late 2012. And it has crashed 63% already. It's likely headed lower, down a total of 70-80% in the years ahead, especially with sunspot cycles suggesting a bout of cooling into late 2019 or early 2020. And so, major stock bubbles tend to come every 60-80 years, in line with the average human lifetime. Commodity bubbles rise into the high point of the 29-30-year commodity cycle. and real estate bubbles come on the 80-84 year four-season economic cycle. But real estate has its own 18-year cycle. We're in the twilight of the greatest and most pervasive bubble in modern history. Commodities burst first, and then real estate in elective areas follow suit. This third major bubble in stocks is last, and it's set to burst by late 2017. Now, just imagine how much more effective politicians, world leaders, business leaders, and central bankers would be if they knew about this stuff. All they need is an understanding of all the cycles at play, and my bubble model prototype, and they could actually be useful. A man can dream. Of course, there was one sector I didn't talk about in this chapter, possibly the one of most interest to everyone. But before we get into that, Andy has some details to share about how we can fine-tune our forecasts.
Chapter 11. Missing links from past financial crises. The simplest way to forecast is to look for the birthdays. Andrew Pancioli. By now, you should see how the macro cycles repeat, often with incredible accuracy. However, as a trader and investor, you still could lose your shirt if you're a few weeks or even a few days out. Knowing when the big cycles come in is useful, but clearly you need to be able to fine-tune this information. That's where I come in. Forecasting shorter-term cycles is a completely different kettle of fish from working with the macro ones. The simplest way to forecast involves looking at anniversary dates or birthdays. You'd be surprised at how often markets make highs and lows on the birthday of the previous year or on the birthday of a previous cycle high or low. For example, take the dates of October 4th and 5th. They are the birthdays of some interesting events. Looking at the US markets, we see the 1931 market had its annual low. The 1974 market had its annual low. The 1979 market had its annual high. It was the beginning of the 1987 crash. The 1992 market had its annual low. The 2011 market had its annual low. And the 2012 market had its annual high. There are some dates in the yearly calendar that occur more often than others, defying all statistical probability. October 4th and 5th are two such dates. If we apply this type of information to the cycles that we watched for potential turning points for autumn 2017, they include 90 years ago, in 1927, the market reached a high on October 3rd, just one day off the time window above, and sold off into October 24th. 60 years ago, in 1957, the market reached a high on July 16th, and the final low came on October 22nd. 30 years ago, in 1987, the market reached a high on August 25th, then a secondary high on October 2nd, and the final low came on October 20th. Can you see how closely these three 30-year cycles correlate? If we were to subtract the 20-year cycle from 2017, then we'd see that the market sold off sharply into October 28th, 1997. In other words, four of my major recurring cycles made significant lows between October 20th and October 28th. However, it's not as easy as all that. There is a whole series of dynamic and static cycles. That means the cycles are of differing lengths and vary within each set. This makes the task far more complex than simply looking at linear time cycle repetition or static sequences. Another factor that comes into play is proportionality. Every market has its own DNA, but it changes and mutates with time. That's why we sometimes see long bull markets, and at other times we see short ones. I get all of this information from my proprietary profit-finding oracle system, PFO, in the Market Timing Report software suite. It enables us to identify high-probability turning point days well in advance. We do it by distilling macro events down from yearly to monthly to weekly to daily, and potentially even hourly cycles. The cycles are resolved into histograms, and trend changes are possible where spikes occur. Histograms can forecast into the future. Those are longer-range cycles. The bottom line is that whenever we see a significant peak in the histogram, we know a turn is coming. Somehow, in some way, the market will be impacted. This is incredibly valuable information. Because we know where the future turning points are, we know when the market trend is likely to change. But how do we know if a turning point is going to be positive or negative? Quite simply, if you know the direction of the market as it moves into a histogram spike period, it'll most likely reverse course. In other words, if the market is trending up into a turning point, then it'll likely roll over, and vice versa. This isn't just a hypothesis. This has worked time and again since I created it. We identified the exact high for the euro in May 2014, the collapse of crude oil, and the swing highs and lows shown on the S&P 500 chart. But that's not all. We can then take this several stages further by adding different layers, which also help us identify when the major and minor cycles align. In the chart of the euro against the US dollar, on the PDF, you can see how three different cycle sets are used. The bottom line of histograms shows the longer-term cycles. These are the major turning points in the market. The two layers above identify the shorter-term cycles through two different algorithm sets. The vertical red line shows where the different sets all line up. This coincides with a major high in the market. The software creates the histograms in advance. This enables us to get a handle on what's coming up and how we can fine-tune the forecast to the day. Let's look at what's coming up over the next few years. But remember that these cycles are always provisional and are updated as each time window approaches. With that health warning in mind, Harry will start with real estate.
Chapter 12. The Modern-Day Mount Vesuvius in Real Estate. When this insane real estate bubble blows, it's the everyday, hard-working folk who'll be slaughtered again. But guess who owns the most real estate? That top 0.1 to 10%. Harry Dent. Sadly, it's not only the stock market bubble that the experts and people in general seem to be missing. Real estate has reinflated back into bubble territory as well. And in many countries like China and Canada, it's gone to insane new highs. It's mind-blowing how people can deny what's right in front of them. A husband gets caught cheating on camera, but when confronted with the video footage, he denies it was him. Like the famous South African rugby player, Joost van der Westhuizen, who denied that the man having sex with a prostitute in the grainy video was him. Or a politician gets caught doing something illegal, like Marion Barry being filmed smoking crack and then responding, "allegedly smoking crack." Or a president denying he's deployed troops to a region, like Vladimir Putin saying there is no Russian army in the Ukraine when there are men in green, clearly the Russian army, killing thousands of Ukrainians. Or that the new real estate bar of $250 million is not indicative of a new bubble. It's a bubble, damn it. And people are going to get slaughtered when it bursts. Rich people the most, but everyday people as well, just as in the 2008 financial crisis. I wrote an article for Economy and Markets in April 2017, headlined "The $1 Billion Bargain." The coolest house I ever saw, I said, isn't a house. It's Antilia, a 27-story skyscraper in Mumbai. Mukesh Ambani, chairman of the second-largest oil and gas company in India, Reliance Industries, built it for a cool $1 billion. It's a 27-story skyscraper in the heart of the hottest city in their country. It has 6 levels just for parking, and 3 helipads. Man! Imagine the parties you could throw there, in a city where there's no parking anywhere, anytime. for $1 billion, Antilia is actually more of a bargain. It's 400,000 square feet of living space in the best part of one of the largest and most densely populated cities in the world. When you break that down, it works out to just $2,500 a square foot. Compare that with the top penthouses on Central Park these days. In 2012, the most expensive was the 6,744 square feet at 15 Central Park West. It cost Sandy Weill, former chief of Citibank, $13,049 a square foot. The first condo to break the $100 million mark in 2015 was at 157 in Midtown Manhattan. It cost $9,136 per square foot. As I was writing this book, the leading-edge penthouse at the newest 220 Central Park South was being offered at $250 million for 23,000 square feet. For four floors and 16 bedrooms in the hottest part of Manhattan, you need only fork over $10,870 per square foot. We whisked by the $200 million mark without blinking. Yet buyers think you can never go wrong buying the most prestigious properties in the hottest cities? History proves otherwise. I spell these bargains B-U-B-B-L-E. Of course, it can't just stop there. Beverly Hills won't be outdone. A 53,000-square-foot property with vineyards was listed for $195 million. Hey, that's only $3,679 per square foot more in the countryside. And a listing in Bel Air just came up for a whopping $250 million. There must be some kind of elite rich guy club that stipulates you can join only if you buy a home for at least $250 million. And guess what the developer had to say about this new listing? Why would a billionaire pay $220 million for a yacht and not that or more for his house? That's bubble logic if I've ever heard it. A yacht moves, a house doesn't. And I wouldn't touch that $220 million yacht with a 10-foot pole. Yachts will be selling for pennies on the dollar in the years ahead, as will this house. That $250 million house is 38,000 square feet. It has 12 bedrooms, 21 bathrooms. Rich people must need to pee more from all the champagne they drink. The house has 5 bars, 3 kitchens, a 4-lane bowling alley, an 85-foot infinity pool with an outdoor pop-up theater-size movie screen, and an indoor 40-seat movie theater. And, of course, a helipad on top. At $6,578 a square foot, this is very likely the highest price ever asked for a suburban mansion. Personally, I'd take the $2,500 per square foot skyscraper in Mumbai over any of these U.S. bubble homes. It's a bargain in bubble land, yet still likely to decline in value in the coming years first. But then I can see this bubble, while apparently it's invisible to anyone else. The high end is clearly going nuts, and such scenarios have never ended well. When I was looking at moving back to Miami from Tampa in 2016, high-end condos that had been going for nearly $1,000 a square foot in 2007 were now going for $2,000. Some were as high as $4,000. That's double, and then some. And there were more cranes in Miami in 2016 than anywhere I've seen in the United States, even more than I saw there in 2006 and 07. The final blow-off. The luxury market in Manhattan is seeing average sales of more than $9 million recently. The last significant bottom in this market came back in late 2001. I have a test for real estate based on my bubble principles and prices tending to crash back to their bubble origin. This isn't perfect, but it's the best indicator of what your downside potential is. It's simple. Find out what your real estate was worth at the beginning of January 2000. That simple indicator would suggest that your downside risk on a $9.4 million condo today in Manhattan would be about 73%, My worst-case scenario would be 77%, and the less likely best case would be 48%. Do you think all-knowing rich people in New York believe such a crash could possibly happen in the greatest city in the world? Of course they don't. They're wrong. The first wave up peaked in late 2000, and then there was a minor two-wave fall into late 2001. Then there was a sharp advance into late 2008. It seems that when the stock market started to crash heavily in 2008, investors switched over to real estate in Manhattan. Not for long, though. The market fell sharply into early 2009. It has been in a final blow-off fifth-wave move ever since, with recent prices hitting $9.3 million on average, while the billionaires fight over $100 million-plus condos. Since late 2001, luxury prices have advanced by 4.4 times over 16 years. That's more than in Sydney, Australia. Prices have moved up by 2.07 times, or 107%, since early 2009 alone, with most of that coming after 2012. This kind of price acceleration won't continue for much longer, not with the tsunami of cycles crashing over us and the revolution underway. And there are so many potential sparks that can ignite the implosion of this and the stock market that it's just a disaster waiting to happen. I'll tell you of at least six possible triggers in the next chapter. To summarize again, the best-case scenario for the luxury real estate sector is that prices fall back to the 2009 low, around $4.8 million. That's a loss of 48%. The worst-case scenario is that they fall back to the late 2001 low, near $2.1 million, shedding 77%. Later in this chapter, I'll explain how I can be so precise with these forecasts. Of course, only a small percentage of Americans live in these luxury houses and condos. So what about normal America? Get your hard hat on. The high-end markets tend to bubble up the most and then collapse the fastest. Manhattan in the 1930s is the prime example. Real estate dropped 61%, more than twice what the average home in America lost, at 26%. Then it took until 1954, 21 years, to get back to the bubble highs, while middle-class homes had reinflated by 1940. Still, average Americans took it in the shorts when prices fell, and nothing has changed today. Demographia has some of the broadest global data and uses the median home price to median income index to give a better picture of the wider U.S. real estate markets around the globe. If we look through this lens, the usual suspects come up as having the greatest bubbles. China, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the U.K. But the United States and Japan are absent from that list, even though California is home to the most overvalued properties in the United States. That's because both have already seen significant bubble bursts, especially Japan in the 1990s. In fact, Japan's residential real estate is still down between 60 and 67%, depending on which measures you use, with commercial real estate still down closer to 80%. And it's still a bit overvalued when compared with more normal levels of 3x income. As far as the United States is concerned, real estate took a beating from early 2006 to late 2012. But since then, it has slowly trended back up into bubble territory. Only this time, it's not a countrywide phenomenon. Like in a popcorn popper, certain areas have bubbled up again sharply, while others remain more subdued. We're on the cusp of the bubble areas imploding. The trick is to know whether you're in one of those areas or not. The most expensive homes, of course, are in China. It's important to note that these valuation measures are much lower than the average because they don't include the high-end markets. Normal valuations in Hong Kong, covering all levels of property, are closer to 36x income. Yet looking at median home price versus median income, it's still a whopping 18x. How many everyday people can afford that? None, of course. Only wealthier foreigners or speculators can pay those prices. And it's the cities that attract the affluent and the foreign buyers laundering money out of their countries that have more expensive real estate. On the mainland, it's a little better. Buyers need to pay only 12.8 times their income to become proud homeowners. That means someone with a typical $10,000 per year income is paying $128,000 for a condo in the city. The equivalent in the United States would be someone who earns a typical income of $60,000 per year, paying $768,000 for a house. Does that sound sustainable to you? It absolutely doesn't to me. Who's next in bubbly prices? New Zealand, thanks to pricey Auckland. The rest of the country has more sheep than people, yet it comes in at around 10 times. Australia comes in at 7 times income, but it's the most expensive at the extremes.